Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Supreme Court and the separation of powers. And Richard, we turn this week to a case that actually went before the Supreme Court today, on the day that we're recording this, involving specifically the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, but more generally the separation of powers. So a quick refresher for our listeners, the CFPB was created back in 2010 as part of the Dodd-Frank law and given broad, very broad regulatory powers in parts of the financial sector that deal directly with consumers. It is set up as an independent agency housed within the Fed. It gets its budget from the Fed, so it requires no congressional appropriations. And rather than having a governing board, it has a single director. And what is most immediately at issue here in this case is that the legislation that creates the CFPB says that that director is only removable by the president for cause. So let's just start with that one narrow point, Richard. The people who wrote this law said they wanted to insulate this position from political pressure. So that's why they gave it this extra barrier between it and politics. Is that arrangement, to your mind, legally defensible?
Well, you certainly start with the hard question. Let me just back up a bit.
Okay.
You said people in favor of this. This is the brainchild of Elizabeth Warren.
Right.
Early on, but even before she was in the Senate, in terms of the things that she thought ought to be done. The first head of the operation was Richard Cordray, one of my former students, I might add, who ran for governor in Ohio and lost. And the earlier case on this was a case called PHH, and this involved very dramatic facts, whereas the facts that you start to see in the current case, Sela, are so boring that they're a snore. It was a case in which somebody had been found by subordinates inside the Consumer Fraud Protection Bureau to have engaged in certain irregularities, and they thought a $5 million fine was appropriate given all the circumstances. When it gets up to this single director, Richard Cordray, the fine goes from $5 million to $105 million. And this was somebody who had relied reasonably, most people thought, on some previous instruction about a very complicated area. There were many people who thought that there was no mistake at all. And the argument is this is what dictators do. And so there was no question that if you wanted to go after this thing for being essentially a world of its own, PHA has really dramatic facts. And it was on those facts that, in a very bruising opinion, that Judge Kavanaugh, as he then was, struck this down before he was reversed on bank. The current case, as best I can tell, involves a series of depositions where somebody or discovery request wants to look at a bunch of papers to see how somebody has kind of behaved in some debt collection issue. It comes right at the beginning of the case, so there's no particular errands or stuff. He's saying, I just want to resist these things. And they're saying, well, you've got to do it. And he says, well, you can't order me because this is not a valid situation. So the question then is exactly what do we think about this guy? And the argument is, and there's a lot of debate over this, is whether you just get rid of the man or you have to get rid of the agency. I am deeply hostile to any system that gives one person plenty potentiary power, independent of any other constraint by any other branch of government anywhere in the world. This is a case in which there is no review. This is a case in which there are no budget constraints, because it's not as though the budget is determined by the Federal Reserve Board. It's the budget is sent through the Federal Reserve Board, but it's acquired as a right. And so if you're trying to think about how you run a system in which you have checks and balances and separation of powers, this is not the way to do it. One of the things that's often said is, well, you know, the Social Security Administration has a single director. But this is a completely kind of odd analogy. First of all, the single director doesn't have life and death over individual cases the way in which Cordray did when he socked somebody with a $105 million firm. These are zillions of small cases distributed throughout many, many offices throughout the United States. And the Social Security office doesn't have any enforcement powers the way this does. So to me, it is utterly antithetical to the current situation. The issue is just how far do we go? Because there is something known as Humphrey's executor, an important case. Ostensibly, it dealt with whether or not a dead commissioner was entitled to have his family get his salary. That's why it was Humphrey's executor. But the question was whether it's ever permissible to have independent agencies in the United States when the Congress and the president and the courts are the only three branches of government mentioned in Articles 1, 2, and 3. And the, whatchamacallit, the Supreme Court, speaking through Justice Sutherland, said, well, this is perfectly obvious. This is a quasi-something or other, legislative or quasi-judicial body. Quasi means it's not one of the three bodies. It's a fourth body. And so what happens is if you really believe that the quasis can carry the work, you're going to allow independent agencies to exist so long as they have multi-member boards. But then the question is, are you going to allow them to exist when it turns out they have only a single member? And that's where Justice Kavanaugh drew his line. But you could see many other people saying, look, this whole notion of having a floating independent administrative body is not one that's acceptable. So you should strike the whole thing down. Humphrey's executive came down in 1935, just at the advent of the New Deal. That would be a huge palace revolution. So the betting is that if they strike this thing down, it will be because of the single executive, not because of the insulation of the organization. And if you looked at the argument, even a summary of it, if they're nine Supreme Court justices, they're probably 14 separate positions.
Okay, so let me actually build on the point that you just made there, because there is a big question in this case about the issue of severability. That's something our listeners may remember from the first round of debates about Obamacare.
Yes.
So severability, the issue there is when and whether you can strike down one aspect of a law without taking the rest of the law down with it. So as you outlined, there are people who say that the court should strike down the part of the law that protects the director, make that person essentially removable at will or build a board, but leave the rest of the institution intact. And that, as you said, is in fact the way that Judge Kavanaugh ruled on this when he heard it back when he was on the D.C. Circuit. Of course, he might feel free to be a little more sweeping on the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
we don't know.
Yeah, it's also the way in which Noah Francisco argued the case.
Well,
he's a Solicitor General, and he wanted severance because—and so he couldn't represent the Congress because there was conflict with the president. And so then they brought in Paul Clement, old reliable Paul, to represent the congressional position and try to uphold the statute. At the same time, the plaintiff was saying the king is dead, this whole thing ought to be struck down. So this was a very interesting tripartite argument.
Well, so on this issue of severability, can you walk us through how judges come to the determination of what's severable and what isn't, and how it might apply here?
Well, they do it all sorts of different ways, which is part of the charm, all right? Well, the first thing, of course, is do you or do you not have a severability provision in there? And if you do have one, it's obviously going to improve the odds that the severance will be allowed, but it doesn't make it necessarily the case if you think these things are overly integrated together. So when you go back to the Obamacare case, one of the key questions was whether you could sever the individual mandate from the rest of the statute, right? And I remember sitting there talking to a bunch of people who were interested in this case. I said, do you actually know what's in the rest of the statute? And I'll tell you what, I will give you an extra lollipop for Christmas if you can tell me what the BPCIA is.
Oh, me? You will give me the extra? I'm going to have to pass on the lollipop. I couldn't.
You're going to have to pass on the lollipop. It's the Biological Protection, Competition, and Innovation Act.
Well, of course.
Which is a separate bill which had to do with the way in which you allow for imitation of biologics made by one company to be made by generic companies. I've actually wrote a long article on that, which was understood by me and a woman named Erica Leitzen, who walked me through the whole darn thing. but nobody else understands it. But what happened is nobody, including Paul Clement, actually knew that this was in the bill. So when they were starting, or in the legislation, so when they started looking at this thing, they wanted to strike down the whole legislation. Do you want to take this hard-wrought compromise, which has been put together, and strike it down because the individual mandate is defective? I said, you don't want to do that. I said, what you want to do is you think the mandate is essential. You may go after Title I, Title II, the basic coverage plan, maybe the Medicaid expansion plan, but you don't want to go after the BPCIA. So there's obviously a point in which severability becomes almost a moral necessity. then, on the other hand, in this particular case, if you do this, there's a real close question. You have clearly the argument that they said it could be severed. Then you have to ask, how transformative is this? And I, in fact, as I change my mind often, I have come to the conclusion, as of what time is it now, 8:50 in the evening, that it's probably severable. Why is that? Because I don't think that the way in which the actual statute is going to operate is going to change radically if the fellow is now removable at the will of the president, because it's not as though when you try to engage in severability, you're going to have to, say, put together a board of five and have somebody appoint them. If that were the only alternative, I do not think you could sever it, because it is a fundamentally different arrangement with a five-person board than a one-person board. But if you say it's serving at the will of the president, it becomes more like a cabinet member. It doesn't strike me as though it's so revolutionary that you don't want to do it all. The second point that I think really starts to matter in this case, if you strike the whole thing down, you have the Noel Canning problem, which is you run a board which doesn't have sufficient members. Are all of its decisions void? Well, you know, this thing has been in operation for many years. You basically strike down the statute and throw this board out. Are you going to have to start to refund a lot of money? Are people who got money pursuant to these things going to have to give it back again? I teach a course in restitution for which money's paid under mistake of law is a very large part of the course. No point in trying to summarize the result except to say that the more you know about the area, the less confident you are in any individual judgment about the area. And so I think, in effect, that the operations will be more or less the same. And I also think that the consequences of just driving this thing down are too radical. So my view about it is that if you're going to basically say that this thing is unconstitutional, as I think it is, because of excessive concentration of powers, what should happen is you should allow the officer to be removable at the will of the president. Congress then could perhaps figure out a way in which they might want to modify this. But I don't think you want to modify this by sort of changing the standard to make it a little bit more difficult to remove this fellow. I think the only real alternative is the one that Kavanaugh said in the PHH case, which is you make it like the FCC, where you've got five commissioners divided by political parties, with the president getting the odd vote.
So if we can take a detour, albeit just by a block or so.
That's all right.
Going from law to policy for a moment, talk to me about the government's role in consumer protection and financial regulation. If we put aside the problems with the CFPB's means, was it at least created in service of worthy ends? Did we need, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, a more vigorous federal role in regulating the kinds of companies that are subject to the CFPB?
Look, this issue has come up in many places. It's not just here. It's also in connection with the issue of what kind of regulation the Obama administration could impose upon brokerage firms. And they wanted to impose very high fiduciary duties in this context. And I thought it would have been a business disaster under the circumstances because of the way in which it would largely cut out low net worth individuals from getting representations, because it's just too costly to service them with full-time registered brokers. What you need to do, or advisors, what you need to do is have ordinary brokers do this. It all depends on what you think about the way this thing starts to operate. And when Richard Cordray was involved, I thought it was much too aggressive. You get a Trump administration, I don't even know who the person is, which is a good sign, because he's not waving waves, or she's not waving waves, and you feel much less hostile. There's no question whatsoever that a Consumer Fraud Bureau, which is actually designed to deal with fraud against consumers, or in some cases fraud by consumers, is not an illicit government function. But the definitions are very broad. The state agencies are already there. And so my own view about all of this starts from my basic libertarian biases, which is, if you've had a long established system which has some degree of oversight at the state level, by and large, you don't want to put in excessive control at the federal level. And in particular, if you start listening to the hyperbolic remarks made by somebody like Elizabeth Warren, where she basically says, you know, one in five mortgages that go into foreclosure are treated in a horrible way under the current system, and we have to stop that. I think that's pretty much hyperbole. In fact, one of the causes, if you want my opinion, of the financial crisis that stemmed out of the 2008 meltdown was that it was impossible impossible to foreclose people, in part because of things like the Consumer Fraud Protection Bureau at the state level. When you don't foreclose, many bad things happen. Tenants stay in, but the tenants are in net worth units that are negative. And so you got a building, you got a mortgage of $150,000, the unit's worth $100,000. It's going to take them 6 months to get you out. Why not trash the place? It's somebody else's house that you're destroying. It's not your own that you're destroying. And a lot of things like that happened. There were some state laws that came involved in this, which also closed down foreclosure. When you close down foreclosure, the units start to get wrecked. When you close down foreclosure, the bank can't relet them to somebody else so that the unit then goes into circulation. So the whole thing, it seems to me, breaks down. So I think, in effect, most of what they were trying to do substantively was wrong. I'm very much a fan of, if tenants don't pay, unless there's some degree of fraud or illegal behavior on the part of the bank, you want them quickly to be removed, just the way you don't want to have a rent control system which allows tenants to stay after the expiration of a lease. If you make sure that foreclosure is quick, and it turns out that many of the people put down very small down payments, it was very common during this period with the CFTC in practice, Consumer Fraud Protection Board in practice, to see a tenant lose his 5% down payment or an owner, and the bank losing 30 or 40, 50% with respect to the same money. Remember, banks failed as well. So, no, I would say offhand, the presumption that I would have is that if Elizabeth Warren wanted it, I would be against it without knowing the particulars. And I know enough about the particulars to think that this is not what you really want. You want consumer protection, not out of sympathy. You want it to protect against various kinds of overreach on the other side. And many of the foreclosure cases that were delayed or derailed were done so on the worst of technicalities. Oh, this was an improper assignment between the bank on the one hand and a third-party collection agency on the other. Well, they should be able to sort out that mistake. But then you say, since the assignment was defective, the transferor in the assignment can't do it, and the transferee in the assignment can't do it, so nobody can do it, and the tenant still stays on. This was a very, very serious problem in this particular period, and so there are many consumer protection bureaus that give consumers too much protection against their own misconduct.
Final question, Richard. People who are listening to a show like this one are probably already familiar with the brief against the administrative state. So the argument goes that we have this constitutional architecture with checks and balances and separation of powers between the three branches. And in marches the administrative state, which is removed from the democratic process, which in many cases performs a mix of executive and legislative and judicial functions. And that as a result, there's both a practical problem here in that this is how you get a huge, unnavigable regulatory morass. And there's a principled one, which is that these structures just upend the system of government that the founders designed. The defenders of the administrative state will often say, look, you crazy conservatives get your way, and every last piece of federal business then has to be conducted by the Congress. You will get an unmanageable system. There is simply too much going on and too much of it that's highly specialized and technical to run a government that way. What's your reaction to that critique?
Well, this is a perfect lead-in to the fact that I will now plug my book.
There we go.
Which is coming out, I hope, on March 15, called The Dubious Morality of the Modern Administrative State. And so much depends upon what it is that you want an administrative state to do. And there are some people who take strong positions, like Philip Hamburger, it's always bad no matter which way it goes. That's not my position at all. We had a huge administrative state all throughout the 19th century, but the tasks were well defined. You have to have an administrative state in order to run a civil service. You have to hire people, you have to fire people. You have to have an administrative state to collect the taxes, to run the customs office. You have to have an administrative state in order to dispose of public lands, create patents, and so forth. So what you want to do is essentially to try to make sure that the functions that they have are very similar to the kinds of functions that sensible businesses do in the private sector. So when you start to look at the way in which land and patent grants are given, the rules should be very similar to those which happen when grants are made by private sellers to private buyers. And amazingly enough, during the 19th century, there was a very clear sense that these two things apply. When you want wanted to get yourself the administrative state in tariffs. You always have to worry about compensating benefits. And in a famous case called Hampden in 1928, when Chief Justice Taft said there had to be an intelligible principle, he meant there had to be a mathematical formula which would tell you what the appropriate tariff was on each set of goods. And that's just fine. Now, the administrative state is going to have to do other things. And let me just give you a couple of examples of how badly these things can happen. My favorite example of this is, in fact, with the FCC. This was a Hoover convention. Hoover was an extremely influential person when he was Secretary of Commerce, and he set up a system first for radio, later broadened to cover television, in which frequencies should be allocated in accordance with the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And so this is not a system which says we want to make sure that people broadcasting on one station are not going to interfere with people broadcasting on another. This is a statement which wants you to make substantive judgment as to who get what's position. And my view about this is I would strike that down on the grounds that the vagueness is so crazy. And I would say, first, figure out what you think the frequencies are, and then auction them off. At that particular point, you'll have property rights in a sensible system. It gets to the Supreme Court. It turns out, ironically, that the lawyers for NBC fighting this was Charles Evans Hughes, who had just resigned from the Supreme Court. He was 79 years of age, I think, at the time of the argument, or maybe 81. And so you have him, and then after that, you get the government guy. Then Felix Frankfurt, who's smarter than everybody else, says public interest, convenience, and necessity. There are two ways to think of it. One of them is the state becomes a traffic cop and makes sure that the frequencies don't interfere, just the way you don't want cars crashing into another. But he says, no. This statute requires much more. It requires the government to determine the composition of the traffic, i.e., what's going to go where. And this is really quite on point, because in 1935, when they passed the Motor Vehicle Act, that's exactly what this government did. It said, in effect, you know, you may carry under a license tomatoes to California, but you can't bring back citrus fruits to Illinois. All those things, massive waste of regulation. That's what he thought would be the appropriate system. So somebody says, okay, Mr. Frankfurt, to do this. He says, how the hell am I supposed to do this? Well, send it back to the FCC so they'll get rules. Well, by the time these rules get formulated 18 years later, they're worse than useless, because they said, well, we give credit for people who have good local coverage, and we love people who have great national coverage, and we like people who have representative advertisements, and we like people who don't have no advertisements at all. So essentially, everything's on a margin one way or another. And so what happened is you ran comparative hearings. Nobody really knew what they were about. Somebody would win this and get the frequency and turn around and auction it off to somebody else to the highest bidder. So you had an unnecessary hearing, and all the money goes to the first licensee. It doesn't go to the United States government. You don't need an administrative state to do that. You need no administrative state. You don't want that to happen. So the kind of things that you're always worried about are those sorts of things where you give things unto the government where it turns out it cannot do in that particular fashion. And so much of what we try to do by having an entire, you know, sentencing system done by administrative rules, that didn't work out, and eventually it became precatory and it went to judges. There is overambition in the administrative state. It has to be something that is curbed. There is too much discretion on how we make things work by having the federal government tell the states what to do. So, for example, the United States federal government can tell a state agency, you have to pay your sheriff's overtime, because we're doing it under the Fair Labor Standards Act, and you're covered. You don't need an administrative state in the federal government to tell state employees the way in which they ought to behave. You should immediately say, the federal government, whatever it has to do with respect to ordinary individuals, it cannot take an equal sovereign and subject them to its administrative rules. So you can pare back one thing after another and get things a lot better than it turns out that they are. And I haven't even talked about really complicated statutes, you know, like, for example, NEPA or the Highway and Traffic Act or the FDA. Many of these things have just very bad rules from top to bottom. And what I try to do in the book, because I'm not a conventional administrative lawyer in the sense that I want to talk about the niceties of document, what I do is I look at the substantive rules in a particular area and watch how in one case after another, a bunch of people who don't know anything about the business that they're regulating manage to create unworkable rules through the administrative state, whether you're talking about the Fair Labor Standards Act or the Securities Act or the Food and Drug Act, anything you want to mention. There is a tendency on the part of too many judges to think that too many people in administration actually know what they're talking about. And if the judges spent less time worrying about the Constitution in the abstract and more time worrying about the business deals in question, they would narrow it down. That at least is the thesis of the book, and that is the moral that I hope one would take with this case. And I think, in fact, if you make the modest change in PHH or in this Sealer case, it will be a change for the good. And my guess is when the dust settles, they will keep the agency in place, they will sever this particular element, and they will decide that the president can remove somebody who in all likelihood he'll keep anyhow.
All right. Give us the name of the book one more time, Richard.
The Dubious Morality of the Modern Administrative State is coming from Roman Littlefield. Should be out on March 15th, and I think it's already for sale on Amazon, and I think at the company's website as well. You can pre-order it. I know of at least two people have done so, and I basically have now re-altered my pension plans.
Okay, well, this episode will get those numbers up for you. Thank you again, Richard.
Up to four.
Thank you to all of our listeners. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. You can also follow him on Twitter. That's at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.